Welcome to another deep dive with us. This time, we're really digging into Revelation. But not just the book itself. We're tackling Kent Hodges' commentary, Reflections on Revelation.
Hodge. Interesting choice.
Right. Like, everyone has an opinion on Revelation, it seems. But Hodge's take is, well, unique to say the least.
Absolutely. He really tries to, like, pin down some of those big questions that everyone gets tripped up on, you know, like who was Revelation written to in the first place?
And when?
Exactly. When was it written? And then, like, how do we even begin to understand this whole apocalyptic style? It can be so dense and confusing.
It really can. And Hodge makes a pretty strong case right from the start, you know, about that first question in the audience. Mm-hmm. He's basically like, look, this was a letter to seven actual churches. Seven real churches in Asia Minor, not just some, you know, symbolic message for all of humanity for all time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what's the significance of that for Hodge?
Well, it's pretty foundational to his whole approach, I think. Like, he's pushing back against this idea that Revelation is entirely symbolic, you know, that it's got no connection to the actual real-world struggles of those early Christians.
Right. So many people just see it as, like, predicting the end of the world. But he's saying there's a lot more to it than that.
Exactly. He's arguing that you can't really grasp the message of Revelation, like you can't really get it unless you understand the context of those early churches.
Their historical context.
Yeah. The Roman Empire, like all the political stuff going on, the persecution they were facing, you know, their hopes, their fears, all of that.
So it's like, I don't know, trying to understand a letter written during the American Revolution, but without knowing anything about, like, the political climate or the people involved.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. Or, like, imagine trying to read a coded message without the key, right? Hodge is saying, like, the key to unlocking Revelation is understanding the world of those first century churches.
Okay, that makes sense. But then how does that affect how we read Revelation today, right? Like, it was written centuries ago. Is it even relevant to us if it was so specific to them?
That's the big question, isn't it? And Hodge would say, absolutely, it's still relevant. But maybe not in the way that we typically think.
Okay, now I'm really intrigued. Let's move on to that second big question then.
Mm-hmm.
When was Revelation written? And Hodge takes a pretty controversial stance here, right? He argues that it was written before the destruction of the Jerusalem temple in 70 AD.
Mm-hmm.
And most scholars place it later, yeah. Right? Like after the temple's destruction?
Yeah, a lot of them do. But Hodge, he built his case based on evidence within the text itself, you know, internal evidence. Like, for instance, he points to phrases like the time is at hand.
Oh, right.
Which suggests like imminent events, right? Things happening soon, not something centuries away.
Yeah.
And he contrasts this with the book of Daniel, where, like, you know, those visions are sealed up,
right,
for a distant future.
Yeah. I can see how that, like, makes you rethink the timeline.
Yeah.
But what about all those dramatic apocalyptic images, right? Like all those intense visions, don't those seem to point to some like cataclysmic future event?
Oh, yeah. And that leads us right into Hodge's third big point, the nature of apocalyptic literature. You know, he doesn't deny those images are intense, but he cautions against taking them literally, right? He says, like, apocalypse, it just means like to unveil, you know, to reveal.
Reveal, yeah.
And this kind of writing, this style, uses really vivid symbols to represent real events, you know?
So it's like a coded language.
Yeah.
Using imagery to communicate something deeper, something.
Exactly. It's like a code. But then the question is, well, how do we crack the code? Like, how do we know what those symbols actually refer to?
Right. That's where I always get lost.
I know, right? But Hodge argues that those symbols, they have concrete historical references, like tied to the first century.
Okay.
For example, he connects the number 666, you know, often associated with the beast.
Uh-huh.
Well, he connects it to the Roman Emperor Nero, who was, well, a pretty notorious persecutor of Christians.
Wait, so the beast isn't some like mysterious future figure. It's a specific historical figure from back then.
That's what Hodge argues. Yeah, he grounds his interpretation. He grounds it in that historical context and the world that those churches were living in. Now, you know, whether you agree with his specific interpretations or not, that's a different matter. But his approach, I think it forces you to consider the possibility that Revelation was primarily addressing those first century events and challenges.
Well, I gotta say, this is already making me rethink everything I thought I knew about Revelation. So, like, if Hodge is right about the audience, the date, and all this, like, symbolic language, how does that actually change how we read the text?
Well, that's where things get really interesting. Hodge's framework kind of provides a fresh lens, you know, a new way to view those often confusing chapters. He really dives into specific passages and offers some interpretations that might surprise you.
All right, I am ready for some surprises. Hit me with those interpretations. Okay, so last time, we kind of left off with, well, a pretty big shift in perspective, right? If we're going with Hodge's argument that, you know, Revelation was mainly speaking to those first century churches, how does that change how we understand some of those key symbols and visions? Like, for instance, we talked about the beast, which, you know, lots of people see as this mysterious Antichrist figure in the future.
Yeah.
But Hodge connects it to the Roman Empire, like specifically to Nero.
Right. And that connection, it goes like way beyond just the name, right? Hodge's point is that the beast represents this like persecuting power that those early Christians, they were up against. You know, I mean, remember, Nero was notorious, right? Like, he was known for his cruelty towards Christians. I mean, there are stories about him using them as human torches, like to light up his gardens.
Oh, that's all.
It's brutal. So, I mean, you can imagine, right? For those early Christians, the Roman Empire, it was this very real and terrifying, like, embodiment of evil.
Yeah, it really puts those images in Revelation into perspective. You know? Like, it makes them so much more visceral and real when you understand that historical context.
Yeah.
So if the beast is tied to the Roman Empire, what about Babylon? That's another symbol, and it seems like everyone has a different interpretation of that one.
Oh, yeah. And Hodge, well, he makes a pretty bold claim about Babylon, too. He interprets it as, get this, Jerusalem.
Whoa, wait, really? Jerusalem?
Yeah, which, I mean, I know it sounds kind of shocking at first, right? Because Jerusalem was, you know, God's chosen city, the center of Jewish faith.
Right, exactly. It seems almost like the opposite of what you'd expect. Why would Jerusalem be depicted as this, like, evil, corrupt city in Revelation?
Well, Hodge, he brings in the Old Testament prophets here, especially Ezekiel. Ezekiel also talked about Jerusalem's unfaithfulness and how judgment was coming for them. So Hodge is arguing that Revelation is kind of picking up on those same themes, you know?
Like, yeah.
It's portraying Jerusalem as having become like Babylon, like a city that had turned away from God and embraced all this idolatry and wickedness.
So it's like a symbolic reversal, almost. Like, Jerusalem, which was once a symbol of God's presence, is now a symbol of rebellion and corruption.
Yeah, exactly. It's a powerful image. And this ties back to Hodge's main argument, right? About that historical context. He thinks that Revelation is addressing this crisis of faith, you know, that was unfolding in Jerusalem, especially leading up to its destruction in 70 AD.
Okay, that makes sense. But it's still a pretty intense message, you know, like it's not exactly comforting. What about some of the more hopeful images in Revelation, though? Like, what about those visions of heaven? Are those rooted in the historical context, too?
Yeah, Hodge would say even those glorious visions of heaven, they're not meant to be taken, like, literally, you know, as literal descriptions of some far-off place. He sees them more as symbolic, representations of, like, God's plan for renewal and restoration, but a renewal that starts, you know, starts here on earth.
So it's not about escaping to heaven, but about God transforming this world.
Exactly. He keeps emphasizing that these visions, they're about the intersection of heaven and earth, you know, like God's kingdom breaking into our reality. And he sees the church as playing like a really central role in that transformation.
Okay. I see how that fits with his whole emphasis on the historical context.
Yeah.
Like, it's about God working through those early Christians to bring about renewal in their world.
Yeah. And even connects those like visions of heavenly worship to the actual practices of the early church. For example, you know, that scene in Revelation 4 where the elders, they cast their crowns before the throne.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he thinks that reflects like the self-sacrificial spirit of those early Christians, you know, who are willing to like give up everything for their faith.
Oh, wow. That's a beautiful connection.
Yeah.
So it's like those visions aren't just abstract symbols, but they're reflections of the lived experiences of those early believers.
Yeah, and it goes beyond just the visuals, too. Hodge also points to the language and the themes in those visions. For example, you know, all that emphasis on God's justice and judgment.
Uh-huh.
Well, he connects that to the persecution that those Christians were going through. You know, they were longing for God to, like, vindicate them, to set things right.
Right, like to make things fair.
Exactly. And those visions, they gave them hope that justice would ultimately prevail.
So it wasn't just pie-in-the-sky hope, right? It was real for them.
Yeah, and that hope wasn't just for some far-off future either. Hodge thinks Revelation was offering them hope for their present situation, you know, a vision of God's power to overcome all those, like, forces of evil that were, you know, that were threatening to destroy them.
Okay, so we're starting to see how even those visions in Revelation, they're deeply rooted in that historical context. What about those letters to the seven churches? Are those specific to that time period, or do they like hold meaning for us today too?
Hodge, he's pretty clear that those letters were addressing like real actual issues, problems that those specific churches were facing. Like he sees them struggling with things like compromise, persecution, false teaching, just, you know, the everyday challenges of being a Christian in a world that, well, in a world that wasn't very friendly to Christians.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's like, you know, reading someone's personal letters and getting a glimpse into their lives and their struggles.
Yeah, and Hodge really dives into each letter. You know, he unpacks the context, the specific message that was being conveyed. He sees them as like a case study almost in early Christian life, showing both like, you know, the triumphs and the struggles, the ups and downs of those first believers.
But even though they're specific to those churches, Hodge probably sees some timeless lessons there, right? Like stuff that we can still relate to today.
Oh, absolutely. He argues that those letters offer like really powerful insights into the nature of faithfulness and discipleship, you know, and just the cost of following Christ. He thinks they speak to the challenges that, well, the challenges that all Christians face really in every age, you know, like trying to maintain a strong faith in the midst of all the pressure and temptations of the world.
Yeah, it's like a reminder that, you know, no matter what time period you live in, those core challenges of the Christian life, they stay the same.
Exactly. And Hodge points out that like those warnings and those encouragements and those letters, that they're just as relevant for us today as they were for those first century Christians.
Okay, so we've seen how Hodge's approach kind of unpacks those symbols of the beast, Babylon, even those heavenly visions, all in light of that historical context. But what about all those dramatic judgments? You know, the plagues, the bowls of wrath, all that stuff. Those seem pretty hard to tie down to specific historical events, don't they?
Yeah, that's where things get a little more complex, even for Hodge. He doesn't avoid those difficult passages, but he's careful, you know. He cautions against taking them, like literally, you know, as step-by-step predictions of future events.
So how does he interpret them then?
Well, he sees those judgments as symbolic representations, mainly. Representations of the consequences, you know, of rejecting God and his ways. He draws a lot on the Old Testament, you know, pointing to those patterns of sin and judgment that, well, that happened throughout Israel's history.
Oh, so he's saying those, like, ancient patterns, they're kind of repeating themselves in the first century.
Right, and he thinks those judgments, I mean, as terrifying as those images are, you know, he thinks they're ultimately part of God's plan to bring about a new creation. Like, it's a refining fire almost, you know, purifying and preparing the way for something better.
So those judgments, they aren't just about God's anger, but about his ultimate purpose of renewal.
Exactly. And Hodge, he really emphasizes that even in the midst of those judgments, God's mercy and grace are still at work. You know, he points to the image of the 144,000 sealed from every tribe of Israel as a sign of God's, like, the faithfulness to his people.
It's a powerful reminder, isn't it? That even in the midst of all that judgment, God's still working to redeem, to restore.
Yes, and that theme of redemption, it runs like all through Hodge's interpretation. He sees those judgments as not just punishment, but as a necessary step in God's plan, you know, to bring about that new creation.
Okay, so we've covered a lot. We've seen how Hodge kind of sheds new light on some of the most confusing symbols and visions in Revelation.
Yeah.
But what about like the end of the book? You know, those final chapters where we get a glimpse of all things new.
Ah, well, that's where Hodge's interpretation really, really shines, I think. He sees those final chapters as both a culmination of those first century judgments and a vision of God's ultimate plan for renewing all of creation.
All right, let's explore those final chapters then and see how Hodge brings it all together. We've been on quite the journey through Revelation with Kent Hodge, right?
Oh.
And now we're at the grand finale, those final chapters where John gives us this like incredible vision of all things new. I mean, it's something that's like captivated people forever, but you know, as always, Hodge brings his own unique perspective.
It's amazing how he ties together those first century events, you know, all that drama we've been talking about, and this ultimate vision of renewal and hope. He doesn't see them as separate things at all, but as pieces of the same puzzle.
So it's not just about, you know, those early Christians and them escaping persecution or judgment. It's bigger than that. Like,
yeah,
it goes beyond their immediate situation.
Exactly. Hodge argues that those events, they were like a foreshadowing, you know, of what God is going to do, like ultimately on a cosmic scale. It's like a glimpse into his plan to redeem and restore all of creation.
Okay, so let's like zoom in on some of those images then. In Revelation 21 and 22, where that classic line, right? Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. Now, Hodge is pretty clear that this isn't about God, you know, destroying the universe and starting over, right?
No, it's not talking about like a physical replacement, more like a radical transformation, I guess, or renewal, the old order, you know, everything that's marked by sin and death and decay, all that's passing away. And God's making everything new, you know, where his presence and his purposes, they are everything.
I love that. It's not about, you know, escaping this world, but about God redeeming it,
yeah,
making it whole again.
Exactly. And Hodge is like really adamant that this renewal isn't just about, you know, people going to heaven when they die. It's about God dwelling with his people in a restored creation.
Yeah.
A world where heaven and earth are like finally one.
Which leads us to that incredible image of the New Jerusalem, right?
Yeah.
Coming down from heaven. It's so powerful. How does Hodge interpret that, you know, with his whole historical framework?
He sees it as a picture of God's kingdom, but like fully realized here on earth, you know. It's a city where God's presence is, where there's no more pain, no more tears, no more death. He even points out that some of the details, like the city's dimensions and layout, they're drawn from descriptions of the tabernacle and the temple in the Old Testament.
So he's connecting this vision of the future back to those tangible symbols of God's presence in Israel's history.
Exactly. He's showing how those Old Testament themes, they find their fulfillment in this vision of the New Jerusalem. And remember, you know, this isn't just some like ethereal otherworldly city floating out there somewhere. Hodge grounds it in that historical context. You know, he emphasizes that the New Jerusalem, it represents like the culmination of God's plan for his people, which started way back with Abraham and continued through the prophets and then, you know, the church.
So he's saying this new creation isn't just like random, but it's the fulfillment of a plan that's been like unfolding throughout history.
Exactly. And it's a plan that includes all of creation, you know, not just like a select few. Hodge highlights that image of the tree of life in the New Jerusalem. And you know how it says its leaves are for the healing of the nations?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he sees that as a sign that God's redemption, it extends to all people, to all creation.
That's a beautiful image. And it's interesting, right? Like, even though Hodge ties so much of Revelation to those first century events, he also manages to maintain that sense of, you know, cosmic scope and significance.
It's a tough balance, you know, but he does it well. He doesn't shy away from the historical context, but he doesn't let it, you know, limit the bigger implications of the text either.
What about the second coming of Christ? That's like a huge part of those final chapters of Revelation. I'm sure Hodge has something interesting to say about that.
Oh, he definitely does. He points out that many of those descriptions of Christ's return, they're highly symbolic and shouldn't be taken, you know, literally. Like, for example, that image of Christ coming on the clouds. It's not about a physical descent from the sky.
Right. So what's it about then?
Hodge says it signifies the manifestation of God's power and glory.
Right.
You know, the culmination of his whole plan of redemption. It's about like the final victory of good over evil, the restoration of everything.
Okay, I see. And what about that image of believers being like caught up to meet Christ in the air? That's another one that people have like debated forever.
Oh yeah. And Hodge sees that as like a symbolic representation of believers, you know, being united with Christ in his victory, in his reign. It's about, you know, being part of that new creation, sharing in its fullness and joy.
That's a really beautiful way to think about it. It's not about escaping, but about being like transformed by God's power and taking part in his work of renewal.
Exactly. And he emphasizes that this transformation, it doesn't just happen in the future. It starts now in the present as we surrender to Christ and let his spirit work in us.
It's amazing how Hodge connects those like huge cosmic themes with the everyday stuff of being a Christian. He shows that those big ideas, they really do have practical implications. you know, for how we live, for our relationships, the choices we make.
It's what makes his interpretation so, I don't know, so engaging, I think. He doesn't just give us a like a dry academic explanation. He invites us to really wrestle with these like profound mysteries of revelation and challenges us to actually live out its message.
It's been quite a journey unpacking all of this. It's definitely given me a new perspective on revelation.
That's the power of a good deep dive, right? And Hodge's insights, they really offer a valuable lens, you know, to view this book that can be, well, so complex and so easily misunderstood.
Totally agree. We covered so much, but I feel like this is just like the beginning, you know, of exploring revelation. What final thought would you leave our listener with as they continue to wrestle with this book?
I think Hodge's main message is that, you know, revelation isn't just about the future. It's about the present, you know,
yeah,
about how we live right now in light of God's promises and his purposes. So as you know, go about your week, think about this. How does this vision of all things new, how does it like shape how you see the world? How does it challenge you? Does it give you hope?
That's a great challenge. Thank you so much for leading us through this deep dive. We hope you've learned something or maybe even discover some new questions, you know, to think about.
It's been a pleasure, really.
And to you, our listener, thanks for being here with us. Keep exploring. Keep asking questions. Keep diving deep.